Good morning. Hello, welcome to our Oak Hall Cafe. I hope you feel comfortable. I hope you have a nice hot drink with you. And do enjoy the cakes that have been freshly baked this morning for you. It's great that you can be here. And two or three times a year, we have one of these Oak Hall Cafes, where, as you can see, we turn this hall into our very own coffee shop. And you're very welcome to come and sit and listen and to enjoy and hear some wonderful stories about all sorts of things that affect the biggest questions in life. This morning we have a special guest, Josh Fortune, who's sitting up here with me this morning, and he's come especially to share with us some of his story about what has been happening in his life over the last few years. Josh wrote a book called 3 Years at War, and I've just read this recently, and it's an account of his time as a cameraman in Afghanistan. And he's going to share this morning a bit about his journey out there, what happened on the front line of battlefields in Afghanistan that we hear often on the news. So he's going to be telling us about his stories there this morning. And just as I woke up this morning, there was more news of war, as we often hear each day. And in Afghanistan, the place we will be hearing about this morning, even just this weekend, there were more suicide attacks out there on some of the defense bases. And there are over 21 people killed just this very weekend through acts of the Taliban and others who are fighting and causing chaos and terror in their countries. Josh has had experience of being under fire himself from such people, and he's going to share this morning about what that was like and his journey through that and his discovery of God and where is God in the midst of war and pain and all these sort of things. So, Josh, welcome this morning. I'm glad you could be here. I've got a video to show us all that you've shot and filmed yourself, and then I'm going to hand over to you just to share and to tell us about your time this morning. So let's watch the screen and watch this video. Rather than me interview Josh this morning, I'm going to hand over to Josh, who's going to share his story himself and walk you through the things that he's experienced the last few years. And at the end of his time talking with us, have a chance to ask any questions, and I'll sort of respond and feedback with him. So if you have a question that comes up as you're thinking about the things that Josh is saying this morning, please text them to me. I've got my phone up here. The number's on the screen there. And hopefully at the end, if we've got time, we'll see how many of the questions we can get through. So do have a think and text me any questions you like about what Josh has said or anything else, your big questions you've got there about his experiences. But I'm going to hand over to you now. Josh, we give him a round of applause as he comes to speak to us.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming out this morning. I know Sunday mornings often people just like to lay in bed, so it's really nice to see so many people coming to listen to me. And I do promise that I will do my best to try and keep you entertained and that you won't regret coming out this morning. But if you're a bit like me, and when somebody starts a talk, you sort of begin to switch off a bit, I won't hold that against you. But what I will say is that I'll tell you what I want, what the takeaway message of this morning is now. So if you are going to switch off, at least you know what the message is, okay? I want you to know that whatever you're doing in life, wherever you are, whatever problems you're facing, God can be trusted. Whether you're a Christian here this morning or not, I want to tell you that you can trust God. Maybe you know that already in your life, maybe you've experienced it, or maybe you've never spoken to God before in your life. Well, hopefully my story will show you why he can be trusted. But that's the takeaway message, so if you want to switch off now, you can, but hopefully you won't. My story starts late February 1985. A baby has been born very, very prematurely. So prematurely, in fact, that the doctors say this baby is going to die. because its lungs are not fully formed. They call in specialists who also say, "I'm sorry," to the mum and dad, "but he's not going to make it." But these boys' parents believe in Jesus, and they know that the final authority over life and death rests with God. So one night, they are praying for him. The mother is in the maternity area, the father's in the visitor's ward, and three families in the boy's church are praying for him in their houses. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, every single one of them, in their different locations, gets an overwhelming sense of peace from God that their prayers have been answered. So they thank him and go to bed. The next morning, the doctor walks in and he sees the father sitting by the incubator, beaming. And you can imagine that the doctor thinks, well, this guy's probably losing it a bit. You know, he's about to lose his son. Fair enough. And the doctor says, "Why are you smiling?" And the father says, "I believe that God has healed my son." Again, you can imagine what the doctor was thinking in his head. So he pulls out the graph that charts the baby's heart rate and breathing rate. And from 2 o'clock in the morning, the graph went straight up. God did a miracle, and 31 years later, the baby's grown up, and it's a lot bigger and a lot fatter, but it's me. And my parents actually called me Joshua, and some of you that know what that means, Joshua means God is Savior. So I guess you could say that I've known that God is able to do amazing things, that God can be trusted from before I was even able to know or understand anything. I grew up in a Christian home. My mum was a doctor. My dad was a pastor, but for many years, and I'm sure there are people in this room, particularly younger people, who've grown up in the church their whole life, it didn't seem real to me. You know, yes, I understood, I attended church, I sung the songs, you know, I prayed, but I was sort of dining off my parents' faith. It wasn't a real thing to me. And my dad, instead of, you know, trying to like, you know, brainwash me or force me to do something, he said, "Look, son, I believe that God is out there. I know God is out there. And the Bible says that if you seek him in faith, you will find him." So every day I started just going to the woods just for a little bit just to pray and say, "Look, God, if you're there, just show me. And, you know, let me understand that you are there and that you can be trusted with my life." And it took a while. And the Bible tells us that, you know, persistence is needed in seeking God. And one night I was at a youth camp and I was just in my room praying as usual. And I just had this overwhelming sense of peace come upon me. And I knew that my sins had been forgiven. I'd repented of them and I knew that Jesus had come and he had died for my sins because he loved me so much. Not because I deserved it in any way, but because he loved me. Well, at school, I wasn't a particularly active person. We had several rugby teams, A being the best, F being the worst. I was in the F team. We were only ever allowed to play one game and we lost 45-0. So we weren't allowed to play again after that. So I don't quite know how I ended up joining the army. But when I did A-levels, I did English as one of my subjects. And I'm sure anybody that's done English A-level in recent years will know that you do a unit on war poetry. And I remember looking at that unit, and it was particularly, you know, focused on the poets from World War I, like Owen and Sassoon. And reading what those guys went through was just horrendous. You know, I'm sure anyone that has read them here, you read those poems, you think, what must that have been like to be in that situation where people are trying to kill you, when your friends around you are dying? How can they do what they did? How could they have the bravery to do that? And a question sort of began to form in my mind, like, if I was in that situation, how would I react? All I had to go on was my rugby experience, in which I sort of walked around a cold, muddy field thinking about Star Wars and not really participating. So I didn't think it would go that well if I was in a war, but I was really curious. And around that time, the Iraq war started. And for those of you that remember, you know, it was wall-to-wall coverage. All the news stations were running with it all the time. And it was a very just sort of fascinating thing because war had never been covered like that. And I was watching a lot of it. And I sort of thought, you know, what must it be like to be out there, to be a soldier? A few days later, I was walking down the high street of the local town, and there were some army recruiters there. And I spoke to them, and they got me. And I came home, and I said, "Mum and Dad, I'm joining the army." You can imagine how thrilled they were at that. So they were able to sort of talk me out of it to a degree so that I would join the reserves first. And if I got on well there, and they thought he won't get on well there, then I could maybe join the regular army after that. So I joined an artillery unit, and their job is sort of to shoot down any enemy aircraft. But I soon realized that having the Americans on your side, they will bomb any enemy aircraft well before you even get close to it. So, you know, it's an expensive piece of equipment, but it's never been used, as far as I know, and it's been around for about 20 years. But I noticed that whenever we were in the mess hall, which is sort of like the eating area, whenever paratroopers walked in, everyone would sort of fall silent and whisper, like, you know, envious slash nasty things about them. I mean, they were admittedly, you know, fairly arrogant and stuff, but everyone sort of respected them because they were so physically fit and, you know, jumping out of planes, and it was a really cool thing to do. So I went to my commanding officer and said, "Sir, I would like to transfer to the paras." He burst out laughing at me, which I didn't think was the sort of the best response. And then when he saw I wasn't joking, he started swearing at me a lot. And he was like, "You know, Fortune, you could break your leg and, you know, you could really hurt yourself." And in situations like that, I'm not very good. I started giggling, which made him swear more, and it was getting out of hand. But he very kindly granted my transfer request, I think, again, expecting to see me back a few months after with my tail between my legs. But I went on the sort of course to become a para, and it's sort of a six-month course, and it's very, very difficult. It culminates in this awful week called P Company. I know the Blue Peter guys did it a few years ago, and every now and then they run a program on it. But it's sort of like a really unpleasant week of physical tests, things like running 10 miles with all your equipment on in about 1 hour, 45 minutes. Another thing they do is called milling, and they put you opposite somebody that's about your height and weight in a ring, and you just got to punch each other for a minute. There's no block. If you block or dodge, you fail the event, because it's supposed to simulate having people shooting at you and being able to be brave enough to give it back to them without, like, shying away. I'd never had a fight in my life, and they put me against a former amateur boxer, so halfway through the round, you know, like, I was bleeding, I had two black eyes, my nose was hurt. He was completely fine. But the officer stopped and said, "Fortune, unless you start putting some aggression in, you're going to fail this event." So I just went crazy for 30 seconds. And again, he looked fine at the end, and I was a mess. But we both got the same amount of points because I'd sort of shown the bravery to keep going in it. But what was fascinating throughout the week was that everybody was sort of trying any sort of supplement they could to give them the edge. I'm pretty sure everything was legal they were having, but, you know, they were desperately just trying anything. You know, I think a lot of it was sort of snake oil, but anything they thought that could help them out. But I'd been reading the story of Daniel in the Bible and his friends, and when they go to this, they get taken captive, go to this new land, and they're chosen to be in the king's advisors. And the king's sort of running similar, you know, sort of seeing who's suitable and who isn't. And Daniel and his friends decide they're not going to do all the other stuff that the other guys are doing. They're just going to trust God and just have water and vegetables and go with it. And God honors them at the end. And I said, "Look, God, I believe you want me to be here. I'm going to trust you now. If you want me to, you know, pass and become a para, I'm not going to try all these extra supplements. I'm just going to eat the three meals a day they give us, and then I'll trust you." We got to the end of the week, and it's nerve-wracking because they line you all up. And they call your number out, and it's like, one, fail, two, fail, three, pass, etc. And they got to me, and I was number eight, and they said, pass. And I was really happy about that, because I think only eight of us out of the 85 that started actually made it to the end. So it was quite a difficult week. And I remember looking at myself in the mirror when I came back that night, and I was just bruises everywhere and black eyes and stuff. But I was so grateful, you know, that God had been able to get me through it. A guy that really, you know, had no rights, no physical, you know, history of being a good sportsman or anything. They soon shipped us off to Iraq after that, and it was actually quite a dull time. I remember 436 hours just standing in a guard tower listening to my iPod, which was hidden underneath my body armor, and just watching the time pass. We were there for 6 months, but nothing really of note happened. And at that time, they were starting to move into Afghanistan. This was 2006. And I'm not sure if any of you remember, there was a rather infamous remark from the Secretary of Defense, who said, Minister of Defense even, he said that he would be surprised if a single bullet was fired in the whole Afghanistan campaign. Well, he was soon proven quite horrendously wrong. But at that stage, when they were asking us to go, we thought it was just going to be, you know, quiet, you know, again like Iraq, and nobody really volunteered. But from, I'm sure as many of you can remember, from 2006, it was far different to that. And the guys who did go were in horrendous fighting. And I was really excited because I got invited to join the Special Forces support group, which is sort of like a step up from the paras, but a step beneath the SAS. And you join them, and then if you're good enough, then you can, like, go for SAS selection after that. And in my mind, that was my life sorted. You know, I was like, right, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be in the SAS. And slowly, I started to slip away from God. Even though, you know, he had got me through the training up to that point, I started to think I could do it myself and that I could, you know, be the big, strong, macho guy and do all this stuff. But God had other plans. We were flying over to Holland for the 65th anniversary of Operation Market Garden, which history buffs will know was a big airborne operation in World War II, where we dropped into parts of Holland to secure bridges for Monty to move his army through. But what we do is, because it was such a big operation, every year British paratroopers go and jump into Holland just to commemorate, and thousands of Dutch people turn up. It's a really good way to travel, actually, because there's no real passport control or baggage handling. You get on a plane in Bries Norton in Oxfordshire, fly over the Channel, jump out over Holland, land in a field, and then go to a pub, and people just, you know, like, buy you drinks and meals, and they're all so grateful because of what our grandfathers did. And it was wonderful. But when we were flying over the Channel, the word came down that the wind speed at the drop zone was gusting at 21 knots. Now, I still don't really know what knots is, but I know that when we did our training jumps, if it was over 13, you couldn't jump. It was too high. So 21 was a fair bit over. But because thousands and thousands of people were there, we just had to do it. And I remember when you jump out of the plane, for about 4 seconds, it's like sheer terror because you're getting hit by the spits as... I'm having a mind blank. What's it called? Slipstream. And you're spinning around, your parachute hasn't opened yet, and, you know, it's a sort of sensory overload. But then your parachute opens, and it's reassuring but slightly painful tug in the groin area. But it's wonderful because it's so peaceful and quiet. And you look around, and, you know, the plane's flying away, and it's a sunny day, and it's like, wow, this is amazing. But then you see the ground coming up. And today especially, on that day, it was coming up a lot faster than usual, and I could see it was pulling me backwards. Some poor guys to my right were landing like in and near trees, and I think they got slightly hurt. But when I hit the ground, I sort of went knees, bum, head, and got knocked out for a few seconds because I hit the ground so hard. And I felt something in my knee sort of go. It wasn't like a sharp pain, but something wasn't quite right. And when I woke up again, my parachute was still sort of inflated, pulling me along, and I had to like cut it away. But from then on, whenever I started running or doing the things that paras need to do, especially carrying heavy weight, I was getting a lot of pain in my knee. And we were training for an imminent deployment to Afghanistan. And, you know, for me, that was a moment, you know, oh, great, I get to go and do special forces stuff in Afghanistan. But the pain got worse and worse. And as much as I tried to lie to myself and tell everybody, no, I'm okay, it got to the stage where I couldn't do any of the build-up training. And the commanding officer pulled me aside and said, Fortune, I'm really sorry, but because you're not able to complete this training, you can't deploy to Afghanistan. So at this stage, you know, you can either choose to leave the army or transfer to another unit that isn't the paras. And I was heartbroken. I was so angry that God had thrown a spanner into the plan I had set out for my life. I chose to leave the army because for me it was paras or nothing, because they, you know, they are quite brainwashed, and fair enough, I guess they need to be to do what they do. But I chose just to go and become a civilian. And I started drinking heavily. I started chasing girls, just anything I could to numb the pain that, you know, my life had fallen apart, that I wasn't getting to do what I had dreamed of doing for years. And I remember one night I was drunkenly stumbling home from a night out in London, and I phoned my friend John, who was still with that unit, and they were flying out the next day, and, you know, to say goodbye to him, and I did. And afterwards, I just collapsed in a field, sobbing, so angry that God had wrecked my life as I saw it. And it's funny, looking back at it now, I remind myself actually a lot of my 3-year-old son, you know, who wants chocolate at 8 o'clock at night, and I know that it's not good for him, but he thinks that he needs it at that time, and if he can't get it, then he gets angry. And throughout that sort of time of my life, I call it toddler mode. I saw toddler mode engaging so many times where I was like, God, if you're not going to give me my way, I'm going to be very angry with you. So my life really went off the rails. And I was coming home from a church football match, and I remember that game because it was the only one we ever won. We used to lose routinely 8-0 every week, but we won that one 2-0. But I had a message from my friend on my answering phone, and he said that they're looking for cameramen to go to Afghanistan and to film there. Now, my knee was a bit better at that stage, and I was able to sort of play football, not carry any heavy stuff, but I was able to, you know, do bits and bobs. And I really wanted that job because at university I'd studied camera work. And when I was in Iraq, actually, I'd kept a little camera in my pocket and had filmed, you know, just what life was like there and made it into a little documentary just for my friends and I. But the BBC saw it and they liked it and they actually showed it on their channel. So I went to the interview for this job and I said, look, I'm not a trained journalist, but I know how to film in a war zone. you know, could I have the job? And it was funny, you know, toddler mode engaging again. On the way to the job, I was like, oh God, if you give this to me, I'll love you forever, I'll, you know, and treating him like a divine vending machine. It's horrendous, you know. A relationship with God should not be like that. It should be for the rough and the smooth, loving him and trusting him 100%. But yeah, I was like a toddler. So I got the job, and on the way back, I was like, God, thank you so much. You know, I'm going to be really good from now on. Oh, it's embarrassing to say. But we soon shipped out to Afghanistan in April 2008. And our job was to set up like a TV service for NATO. So we'd go around on operations and film the good stuff and the bad stuff and give it away for free to the international media. Because we found that the international media, as you can probably imagine, would only cover the bombs and the killing, but when a school or a well was opened, you know, they're not interested. So our job was to sort of cover everything in a balanced way and give it away, so the message of what really was going on there could be spread. So we went there, and there was a team of four of us, and I was the only former soldier, so I sort of took it upon myself, you know, I'm going to be the combat guy. I'm going to go and get all the glory from going to combat, and you guys can go and film the wells and the schools. And it was really bad, because, you know, even though I called myself a Christian, I was still drinking heavily. My life hadn't changed, despite me saying, oh, God, I'll be good if you give me this job. And I even earned the nickname Slosh Josh, because, you know, I used to drink so much on base. And it was really weird that my God, like you could almost say, my number one aim, the thing that I thought would make me happy, would be if I got to go into combat and film footage and get glory from it. Because there's some, with, you know, people that go to war, there is some sort of weird, you know, have you ever seen any war films, you know, when the guys that have been there and done it, you know, they come back and there's something about them where you say, yeah, I want to be like that person, you know, like they've been there and they've seen it. And that's what I wanted. And it sounds crazy to even say it now, but that is what I was defining my life by. You know, I will only be happy if I get this. And I'm sure, and I hope there's nobody in this room that thinks they'll be happy if they go into combat. But, you know, there might be people in this room that have the same sort of thing. Oh, if I get to date or marry that person, if I get that job, if I get that car, if I get that house, then I will be happy. I'm sure there's more than one person in this room that has that at the moment. You're holding up something in your mind, and you think, if I get that, I will be happy. And do you know what? You will get that thing, and you'll enjoy it, but then a few months later, there'll be something else you want. And that's the way that humans work. We do not get satisfied with having things. You always want more. Look at Cristiano Ronaldo, you know, popular footballer, rich, good-looking, and yet you can see he wants more. It's not enough for him. And as human beings, we want more, but for me back then, all I wanted was combat. But do you know what was weird? I got to go on all the combat operations for the first year I was there, but whenever I went there, it would fall silent. It got to the point, you know, the first four times it happened, it was like, yeah, that was unfortunate. But by the sort of 12th, 13th time, I was like a walking peace bubble. Wherever I'd go, it would just go silent. And in my bitter moments, I joked, what if I could clone myself 10,000 times? I could stop the war in a day. I'll just, like, go throughout the country. And all my other colleagues who weren't looking for it and weren't defining their life by it started to get, you know, these combat footage and getting lots of credit and stuff. And I was so bitter in my heart towards them. And I was so bitter towards God. Again, it's embarrassing to say, you know, just, I'm not getting my way, God, therefore I'm not going to like you. So I've been there a year. And it was my birthday, and usually when it's my birthday, I sort of, you know, I'm sure as many of you do, you sort of take stock about where your life's at and you look back over the past year. And I'd taken a Bible with me. I hadn't opened it for the year, but, you know, I opened it up just because I wanted to, you know, try and make myself feel holy again. And I turned to Matthew 6, where Jesus is talking about your worries, and he says, look, if you're a Christian, if you call yourself a Christian, don't worry about the things that everyone else does. And he's talking about food and clothing here, which is far more important than getting good footage. And he's saying, look, trust me, seek my kingdom, love me, put me first, and everything you need will be added to you. Now, that's not like, Lord, I need a Ferrari, I'm going to trust you. Oh, great. It doesn't work like that. God, in the same way I know my son doesn't need chocolate at 8 p.m., God knows exactly what we need, even if we don't understand it at the time. And that passage really cut me to the heart because I realized, like, in fact, I didn't recognize who I'd become. I was, you know, drinking. I was putting, you know, my own glory above anything else in the world. It was horrendous, and it moved me to tears, and I was just like, God, I don't know who I've become right now, and I am so sorry. And do you know what, Lord, like, I'm just going to put you first now. I want to trust you. Please just bring me back to yourself, because, you know, I can't even, as Christians, we can't even choose to go back to God. It's not like, oh, I accept God. No, he puts it in your heart to go back to him. So that's all we can do, just throw ourselves on him and completely trust in him. And I said to him, look, Lord, I'm not going to like chase combat anymore and make that the thing that I think defines me. If you want it to happen, great, but the main thing for me is to trust you. And I'm sure there are other people in this room that can tell you that moment when you surrender your ambitions and your hopes and your plans and everything to God and trust him, there is no better place to be. Genuinely, there's no better place to be. You can take any earthly success, any earthly riches, anything, and they don't even come close to the peace that comes from knowing Christ and trusting him. So guess what happened? 2 weeks later, I was in Helmand with some Estonian soldiers, and we got ambushed by the Taliban. And I remember the first bullet going past my head was terrifying, you know. Bullets, in films, they go like, pew, and stuff, but in real life, like, they make this horrible cracking sound. They apparently rip the air apart because they're going so fast, and then the air snaps back in behind it, which makes this, like, really nasty cracking sound, like a big whip is being cracked by your ear. The first one was about that far away from my head, and I was just like panic stations, you know. I'd never been in combat before, obviously, and the soldiers around me were really cool and just dealt with it. And I just remember saying, Jesus, Jesus. It wasn't swearing, it's the only prayer I could articulate. So I started filming, and a guy next to me got shot in the leg. And it was funny that, you know, when I was in the army, and I always sort of used to imagine what would I be like in combat. And I always saw myself as sort of the brave hero running in slow motion to save a wounded person. And I was like, right, this is my chance. Somebody's been hit next to me. And I got my bandage out, and I was just like that. And he looked at me and said, give it to me, mate. And took it off me and then bandaged himself. So, yeah, that was my hero moment. So I just filmed him doing it. They had surrounded us. A guy, a couple of people down, got hit in the chest, but his plate stopped it from injuring him. And we just had to run out of the village because they would have overrun us. And it was just a constant week of combat after that, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a day, just getting ambushed, getting hit by the Taliban. You know, I saw children get hurt, mortally wounded, and it was really, really difficult just to see all that stuff. But on the other hand, you know, just knowing, you're committing every second to God. I'd never been in a situation, because obviously, you know, living in this country, you know, you don't have to rely on God every second. You know, you should do as Christians. You definitely should be, because we shouldn't take anything for granted. But there's not a pressing, like, need to do so. And then a week later, I was with some British and Afghan forces, because the whole aim of the mission there is to train up the Afghans so they can take over their own security. And we got ambushed again, but this time it was by a far greater number of Taliban. There were about 50 of them, and there was only about sort of 25 of us. And the bullets were going so close to us, we just had to lie down. We were in this sort of muddy field. It was irrigation season, so the mud was very soft. And all we could do was just lie down, because there was another unit in front of us, and we didn't know where they were. So we couldn't just shoot blindly, because obviously we don't want to hit our own people. The Afghan soldiers had thrown their weapons away and were just lying like starfish. I was like just pressed down, and the bullets were just landing around you, and there's nothing you could do about it. You just got to hope they don't hit you. But at that point, we heard the worst thing you could hear over the radio, man down. Somebody in the unit in front of us, who I think the ambush had been sprung on, had been hit, and had been hit pretty badly. And it was amazing. It was one of the bravest things I ever saw. There was a girl called Kate. She was 21. She was about that tall. She was a Navy medic attached to the unit. And she got up on her own, ran under fire to this guy, and started stabilizing him. She won a Military Cross for it, actually, which is the second highest bravery award you can win. But obviously, you know, she's quite small, and she, you know, there's no way she could carry him or anything. And to be honest, she shouldn't have had to do that anyway. So they started asking for volunteers to go and, like, help this guy and to carry him out. So I looked around, and there was, in the section I was with, there was loads of sort of 18, 19-year-old guys, and their eyes were like dinner plates because, you know, they were terrified. And I sort of found myself, even though I hated myself, just saying, yeah, I'll do it. And so, like, 4 or 5 of us volunteered. And the decision to actually get up and run was one of the hardest decisions I've ever made, because it's willing your body to do something which, you know, it thinks could kill it any second. And we started running towards the guy, and because the mud was so soft, it was sucking us up to, you know, your knees almost. It was a real slog. And there was an Afghan soldier in front of me, and he was running really slowly. And I was just like, oh, mate, if I'm going to die because you can't run fast. Oh, yeah, I was getting really angry with him in my head. And I started praying again. And I was just, again, it was just Jesus, Jesus, because I was literally convinced I was going to die any second. You know, I didn't think I was going to even make it to him. But it was amazing. The words from Joshua chapter 1, 9, if any of you know it, it says, it's God talking to Joshua, and you can understand why I like that book of the Bible. But God says, do not be afraid, do not be discouraged, because I, the Lord your God, are with you wherever you go. And that verse just came into my head at that time, and I had this overwhelming sense of peace. Now, it wasn't like, yeah, you're going to be okay, because I didn't know that. You know, and in life, we don't know whether we're going to make it out alive. We're probably not going to unless Jesus comes back before. But I knew that even if it meant I was to get shot in the next second, I knew that I could trust God. And whatever happened to me is for my best, even though I wouldn't see it at the time. And I knew that I could just put my life in his hands. So we reached the guy, and his name was John, and it was awful. The bullet had gone into his jaw and out the other side. You know, he was green, he was choking on his tongue. I didn't even know how long a human tongue was, but it was long, and I just thought, there's no way he's going to survive here. I put my camera away, because there's a time to stop recording, and that was it. So we picked him up and ran him out, and at this stage they stopped shooting at us, because an Apache helicopter came and started shooting at them, and they ran away. But we managed to get John to the helicopter, and not only did he survive, but he also went back to Afghanistan 2 years after, which I thought, wow, real glutton for punishment, that guy. But yeah, he's completely fine. They rebuilt his face and living a completely normal life now. But that whole year, just, you know, from that moment onwards, it just ended up just combat all the time. That night, I was staying at this sort of patrol base, which is sort of base in the middle of nowhere, and they started firing artillery shells at us. And I remember reading about them in World War I poetry, you know, and it's terrifying because you hear a distant, like, boom, and then, and in that moment, you have no idea where it's going to land. You know, this could land on me, it could land on a person next to me, I have no idea. And all I could do was say, Lord, help, you know. And it was really, really tough. And we only had about 6 shells fired at us in that whole time. And then it made me think, you know, those World War I guys getting it all the time, every day. No wonder so many of them suffered mentally afterwards, because it's such a strain. And then I got to go on the largest U.S. Marine air assault since Vietnam, where they dropped 4,000 U.S. Marines into parts of Helmand nobody had been before, where there was enemy territory. And new international news stations were, like, lining up, clamoring to take my footage, because I was one of the only video cameras on it. But what was weird is that a year before, I literally probably would have given my right arm to be in that position I was, you know, getting footage, getting combat and stuff. But it was so weird that being right with God, it didn't even really matter. Yeah, I enjoyed doing it, it was all right, but it didn't even begin to come close to the satisfaction that came from knowing Jesus. And again, whatever situation you're in right now in your life, guys, I can tell you 100%, whatever success or joys or anything you're having in your life right now, it doesn't even come close to the peace that comes from knowing Jesus Christ and knowing that you can trust in him with your life. Well, I'm a natural-born worrier, so then I started to sort of worry about the next thing. My hair was beginning to go. You know, my dad's bald, and I could see it was beginning to happen to me. And you can imagine that the chances of finding a wife in Afghanistan were pretty low, because they were all covered, and if you looked at them, their fathers or brothers would want to kill you. So that was sort of a no-go. Now, we had a very limited internet connection. We used to just carry on these, like, portable satellites that we'd use to upload footage. But I used a fair bit of my bandwidth Googling, do women find bald men attractive? You know, and then sort of looking like people like Vin Diesel and Jason Statham and thinking, well, they can get away with it. I think you just need to, like, get really big and then it's all right. But, you know, having learned what I had learned that year about trusting God, I was like, no, right, close Google down. I'm not going to do this. If God wants me to find somebody, and, you know, he might not do, he knows what's best for me, I'm just going to trust in him. Well, unknown to me, I did know that my dad had left our church. He'd sort of retired. He'd been there for 20 years, and he left to start his own prison ministry. And a new pastor came in, and he had a daughter who was 7 months pregnant. Like me, actually at the same time as me, she had fallen away from God, made some mistakes, got pregnant, and then came back to God. And all her friends, all her non-Christian friends were saying, get rid of the baby. You know, you're about to move to a new place, new church. People are going to judge you. No Christian man's going to want to go near you. Get rid of the baby and retain your freedom. But she knew that wasn't the right thing to do. Even though it meant, you know, possibly her life would be ruined in many ways, she wanted to trust God and come back to him. So I didn't know any of this was happening, but we got to go home sort of every 4 months for a couple of weeks. And I went around to their house, which was really weird because it was my old house, because, you know, being the pastor's son, we used to live in the house. Then when Dad left, we moved out. So it was really weird going back to my old house to meet a new family. But she answered the door, and she was, you know, I was very pretty. And I saw she was pregnant. But in my head, you know, I start sort of, you know, it's crazy that you even start thinking about it this early. But, you know, men sometimes just play things out. And I was like, well, you know, if I asked her for a date and it worked and we got married, how hard could taking on a kid be, you know? I've been shot at, you know. Yeah, if only I'd known. We added each other on Facebook and stuff, but I wanted to try and be wise because, you know, you might have gathered that I'm quite an impulsive person, you know, joining the army on a whim, etc. So I wanted to try and be wise about this. So I was in a place called Sangin. I went back to Afghanistan again. I was in a place called Sangin, and Sangin is one of the worst places in the entire Helmand province, and Helmand province is the worst place in Afghanistan. So it was a really nasty area. It's where we, as the UK, lost the most soldiers and had the most life-changing injuries happen, you know, legs being lost, etc. And there was a Taliban sniper there called Gulab, and we know he was called Gulab because they used to use sort of fairly low-level walkie-talkies, you know, the sort of thing we'd buy in Argos for like a tenner or something. And all you'd need to do is tune into their frequency, and then you could listen to what they were saying with a translator, obviously. And Gulab was a sniper who had killed two British soldiers a week before I came, and everyone was starting to get quite worried about him. It was to the stage now where the SAS had sent in this guy, and it was like somebody out of a film. He was called Master Sniper. That was, you know, that's all we knew him as. His face was covered, and he was apparently the best sniper we have in the country. And his job was to hunt Gulab down. But in order to lure a target out, you need bait. So what they would do is send out four patrols a day, just walking around, just waiting for Gulab to strike. And the master sniper had somehow, I don't know how he did it, but he had identified areas where Gulab could be. And Gulab was very crafty, because it was a sort of town/village. And they had, like, you know, each house has, like, mud brick walls. And what Gulab would do, well, there's no bricks around here, but what he'd do, he would, like, just take, loosen one brick, and when he knew we were out, he'd remove the brick, shoot through it, and put the brick back. So you can imagine, there were about 200-300 of these compound walls. Trying to spot a brick-sized hole, you know, when you're under pressure is almost impossible. So we'd go out, and, you know, I wanted to get the footage, so I went out on each patrol, and it was horrible because it was like clockwork. As soon as you leave the base, their walkie-talkies chime into life, and they're like, right, I can see them, they're on the road. And you look, and yep, we're on the road, and then you cross into a field, they're on the field. And you're just like, oh, you could feel like this crosshair on you. Once he said, shoot the cameraman first. It's like, Gulab, I'm not even armed, mate, this is not fair. And I remember I pulled many of my neck muscles that week, because you're walking around like this the whole time, and as soon as they shoot, you're just instantly going down. But I remember it was like the third or fourth day, and we'd, you know, been getting shot at for the sixth or seventh time that day. And I was like, right, if I survive this, I'm going to ask Danielle out for a coffee, because life really is too short. Managed to get through that week. And actually, on the last day, I think Master Sniper got him. He worked out the hole he was shooting from, and apparently he saw a hand remove it and a barrel stick through, and he just fired a very difficult shot from very far away, and nobody ever heard from Gulab again. So you can imagine the guys that were living, you know, my nerves were shredded after a week there, but the guys that were there for 6 months, you can imagine how relieved they were. So we got back home, and Danielle very graciously agreed to go for a coffee. And, you know, I only had 2 weeks back home. So a coffee turned into lunch, which turned into, like, going to the cinema, which turned into dinner. You know, I had to make the most of the time I had. And, you know, we fell for each other fairly quickly. And again, you know, the prospect, the imminent birth 1 or 2 months away was looming. But, and I knew that, you know, I'd have to go back to Afghanistan and say goodbye to her, and it would be scary and heartbreaking. But, you know, we'd learned to trust God. So saying goodbye to her at the airport, I was sobbing like a baby, and it was really embarrassing because I really don't like, you know, crying in public. But I suddenly found that my priorities had completely changed. Whereas the year before, I'd willingly go into combat, suddenly I didn't want anything to do with it. You know, I wanted to steer clear. But unfortunately, because I'd done okay in the last year, they wanted me for all the combat operations. And they're like, Josh, we've got a mission on. Come down to Helmand. I was like, I don't want to come down. You know, I want to go and film wells and schools. I don't want to get shot at anymore because I've got something, you know, to lose. And the night before a really big operation happened, it was like supposed to demonstrate the Afghan forces and could work together with us. We were going to be dropped into enemy territory at 4 a.m. And I phoned Danielle to say goodbye. You know, I didn't even know if I was going to be alive the next day. And the worst thing possible could have happened. Her mum answers the phone, and Danielle is screaming in the background. They're in the ambulance, and she has gone into early labor. Now, you can imagine psychologically what that had done to me. You know, there I am, a few hours away from going into enemy territory, and the person that I loved was going into labor with a child that, you know, wasn't biologically mine, And it really messed me up. You know, I was really glad it was nighttime when I phoned her, because I sat on a tyre in Camp Bastion and just cried my eyes out. And I was just like, you know, toddler mode was trying to engage itself, and I didn't completely let it. But it was just sort of like, you know, God, it feels like you've designed the perfect way to hurt me here. You know, like this couldn't have happened at a worse time. And what was amazing was that a soldier came up to me, and he had a dog tag in his hand, and he said, "Josh, I found this on the floor. I think it's yours." And I checked, and nope, my dog tags were around my neck. And he said, no, it's got your name on it. It's yours." He gave it to me. And do you know what was written on this dog tag? Joshua 1:9. "Do not be afraid, do not be discouraged, because I, the Lord your God, are with you wherever you go." Now, this guy just found it in the sand nearby, and there were about 100,000 soldiers in Helmand. I was only known to about 100 of them. And the fact that he had found it and had given it to me at that time, that the exact verse that I'd had a year before when I was running to help save John, I'm sorry, that's not a coincidence. And what was incredible is that they stopped her birth. They put hormone, no idea how it works, but they put hormone patches on her belly, and it stopped the labor happening. But what was fascinating is that because it had happened right at that time, right before an operation, my boss said, "Look, this has been pretty unpleasant for you. As soon as you come back from the operation, go home for a week, you know, to hang out with her." I didn't deserve it because I'd recently come back, you know, but my friends and colleagues said, "No, you know, we'll forego our own holiday for a bit so you can go back." It was such a display of grace from them. And flying on the helicopter back from the operation, it was horrible. There was a dead body at my feet. I think it was an Afghan soldier that had been killed. His blood was lapping onto my boots, and I was just like, "I'm really done with this place. I don't want to do this anymore." And what was fascinating, you know, we got to go home, and obviously, you know, being Christians, we didn't want to, you know, do anything wrong. So I'd never stay there at night time. You know, I'd go during the day, and because I lived about 5 minutes away, I'd just walk home. But the baby hadn't come yet, and you know, the week started ticking by, and when I was first flying back, I was like, "Oh, great, the baby's going to come on that week, and it's going to be perfect, and God's great." But then the week started to tick by, and I was like, "Uh-oh, I'm going to have to go back again, and it's going to be the same heartbreak and everything else." And we started, you know, Googling, how do you get the baby out early? You know, do you curries, going on swings? You know, we tried everything. It got to the last night, and at that stage, I'm afraid, toddler mode had engaged, and I was like, "God, why? This is the same goodbye. She's going to go into labor when I'm back in Afghanistan, and really nothing has helped here." I didn't trust God, but do you know what? The baby came that night, and not only did he come that night, he came so quickly that he was born in my old bedroom, in my old house, which was really weird. You know, my mum's a doctor, her mum and the ambulance guys delivered it. Obviously, not being married, I stayed away from the business end and just focused on holding her hand and looking at her face. But it was amazing. Because it was the last night, my boss said, "Look, you can't possibly come back to Afghanistan tomorrow. Have an extra 2 weeks off." You know, it was so funny that, you know, I'd been sitting on that tyre in Camp Bastion crying, thinking that God had designed a perfect way to hurt me. But actually, if that hadn't happened at that moment, my boss wouldn't have taken pity on me and sent me home. And again, God was just showing how he can be trusted. Even in those moments when we begin to think, "What are you doing?" He can be trusted. And the rest of the year went past, and there were combat. I filmed that helicopter video in the last summer I was there, and I was desperately trying to stay out of combat, but, you know, it did happen. And when it did, I just had to say, "God, I've got so much to lose now. I just need to trust you." And I eventually got back, and we got married in 2011, and, you know, we've lived, you know, I'm sure those of you will know, the first year of marriage especially is quite tough. And especially I found going from, you know, riding in helicopters and, you know, going on missions to then changing nappies at 2 a.m. It was a bit of a culture shock for me. But God just showed me again and again, you know, whether you're changing nappies or riding in a Black Hawk, he can be trusted. And that, you know, he will not let you down. Now, does that mean, oh, you know, because some people might be listening thinking, "Oh, you've had it all right. You know, you got what you wanted. So, but in my life, I haven't got what you wanted. So is what you're saying rubbish?" No. I've had a lot of things since then that haven't worked out so well. I've had recently a big venture that I spent 2 years working on. It came out in December, and it flopped, you know. And even though it was heartbreaking, I was so happy that God allowed it to happen, because I know that he's doing it for the best. So my friends, and thank you for listening to me, because I think I've gone slightly over time, but whatever situation you're in, whatever you're facing, whether it's, you know, financial problems, whether it's, you know, maybe a diagnosis that you weren't expecting, whatever it is, even the good things, I want you to know that 100% you can trust God. And if you don't know him this morning, seek him. Go home. I'll ask the guys here, you know, for a Bible. Go home, read about Jesus and seek him. And I promise you, if you go to him in faith, if you go to him trusting him, he can change your life and give you a peace and a security that you have never known. And yes, you know what? Your life may not be a happy ending. That cancer maybe that you've been diagnosed with, or the loved one that's passing away, that might still happen. But you know that you can trust in God and rest your life on him. Well, thank you so much for listening. Cheers.
Thank you, Josh. Have a seat again.
Thank you.
A couple of questions have come through from people, and if you do have any more in the next few minutes, do just text them through to me. Thank you for sharing, and it's what an incredible testimony to God's faithfulness and how you can trust in him. It's amazing to hear. Let me just ask you a few questions, if you don't mind, before we finish up. So someone asks about hearing the crack of a bullet flying through the air.
Yeah.
And what that was like. And are there any other sort of extreme elements like that have really stuck with you from being in combat?
The main thing is the crack of the bullets. And I find whenever cars near me go over gravel, you know, like when cars go over gravel, sometimes I make a popping sound. It reminds me of the snap, and I just go, oh, you know, sometimes. But it's funny, actually. A lot of my friends came home and really, really struggled mentally. And, you know, nightmares, and, you know, their marriages have broken down and stuff. But I've actually, you know, got off very lightly. And I think that's God, because, you know, I'm not, even when I play football now, I'm scared of getting hit with the ball. So I'm not a brave person at all. But, you know, I think that knowing God has had a tremendous impact. So, no, the bullet sound is the only real sound that, you know, viscerally I remember. But even that doesn't really affect me so much these days.
Thanks. How about when you were on tour, did you know any other Christians on the base or out in combat with
Yes,
you?
There were some. It was actually largely the Americans. I'm afraid to say the British were a bit of a bunch of pagans. They didn't really go to the chapel or anything. But the Americans were wonderful. And actually, I actually started learning to preach in Afghanistan, because on the base we were on for the first 2 years, we didn't have a chaplain, so we all just took turns, and that's where I learned. But the most amazing Christian I met was an Afghan Christian called Najib. And Najib had a really, you know, even compared to what I told you there, my life was a laugh compared to his. His dad had been murdered in front of him for showing the Jesus video in his village. He was persecuted. He had nobody. His family all wanted to kill him. He was living above a shop in Kabul. And we tried to just help him in any way we could. So we'd sort of arranged to meet. And he'd stand on a street corner with his face covered. And I'll just drive up, you know, slam the brakes on, throw the door open, he'd get in, and we'd just drive off somewhere and hide and just pray for a bit. And, you know, we used to try and, like, give him sleeping bags and anything that wasn't needed from the base. We would, you know, make sure we weren't stealing it. But then, you know, if we were allowed to use it, we'd just give it to him. And last I know, he managed to escape to France with his sister, and I think is still living there. So that was a couple of years ago. So, yeah, I mean, the faithfulness of Christians there. And there's actually an underground church of expats, so Westerners, in Kabul. And we used to meet at a different person's house each Sunday. And it was funny, the notices always began with, you know, we're here, we get, you know, the prayer meetings on this day. The notices there were, if somebody comes in shooting, this is the door you need to run out of. So, yeah, it was a bit of an interesting, and there was only a select, you know, group of people that knew where it was, so you had to know one of these people and then go travel with them to the church. So it was very sort of hush-hush and secret, because if the police or anybody else knew about it, you would get in big trouble. But seeing the faithfulness of both Najib and these people really challenged me about the things that I take for granted, especially while being back home, church-wise.
Thanks. From reading your book, I remember there's a bit of a journey you went through, going to the little chapel on base, being asked to preach and things there. What are you doing now, and how has your time there helped you with what you're doing now? So you even said, but you're a pastor now of a church?
Yes, I'm pastor of a very small church in Woolwich. It's right next to where Lee Rigby got killed, actually. It's I think it was formerly a sort of a congregational church, but they went through like a few issues a few years ago, and lots of people left. So my wife and I have just come in just to help steady the ship a bit. So I'm preaching there 2 or 3 weekends a month, and it's great. You know, it's very small. We haven't got any musicians. We just use an MP3 player. You know, it's quite rough and ready, but it's great. You know, it feels like a family, and you know, I can see that God is changing people's hearts there, which is all you can hope for, really.
Mm. You didn't tell us as well what happened with Danielle and yourself. I know you're married to her now.
Yes.
And So how did that come about?
Oh yeah, I forgot. Before Jacob was born, I actually proposed to her. Sorry, I forgot that bit of my story. Serves me right for not having notes. But I popped the question to her. I think a few days before Jacob was born, because even though we'd been dating for about 3 or 4 months and we hadn't actually spent much time together, I knew it was the right thing to do. And I bought a ring and asked her dad's permission and then popped the question. So we were engaged for about a year, and then I got married when I came back from Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's lovely. She's here this morning as well, actually.
She is, yeah. She's out with the kids, yeah.
She's probably going out with the kids. So maybe catch up with her later if you'd like to chat with her.
Yeah.
A couple more questions have come through. Someone says, wow, that was incredible. So thank you for sharing. But her question is, what is your favourite war poem? And why? Do you have one?
I think the... I've forgotten my Latin, but it's the Dulce et Decorum Est. Is that? And it's essentially that the old lie that, it's good to die for your country. I think that, particularly looking at the war there, so many of my friends, and one of my friends, Ricky, he lost in Sangin, actually. He was there when Gulab was there, and 2 weeks after I left, he trod on a mine. He's lost both his legs, one of his arms, his eye, part of his nose, And now Sangin has been handed over to the Taliban, and you just think, what was that for? And you give it all this queen and country stuff, and I don't know, honestly, where I stand politically on it. I don't want to be political about it, but I think that often people place, it's good for the country and it's good for the queen and all stuff, but really, Ricky's got to live like that for the rest of his life, and the Taliban are controlling where he lost it. So was it worth it? I don't know. Mm. Yeah.
So the link to that, someone else asks about your Christian belief and how is war and the idea of war in conflict with that being a religion of peace, perhaps, and forgiveness. Did you ever wrestle with that?
That's a very good question, and that's one that I get most talks that I do. Can Christians be soldiers? Well, yes, you can. And the people that counter that say, well, hang on, the Ten Commandments says, thou shalt not kill, doesn't it? Well, no, it actually says, thou shalt not murder. And if you look at the Hebrew word, that's very much about, like, me getting a knife out, doing that. If you look at, God's people, after they were given that law, God then told them to go and make war upon the peoples of the land they were taking over. So, no, and if you look at the way that Jesus dealt with the Roman centurion, when he came and wanted his servant to be healed, did Jesus condemn him and say, don't be a soldier anymore? No, he didn't. So, yes, soldiers absolutely, especially Christian soldiers, have a duty to their conscience, and the law of God should always come first when they're given orders, especially ones that contradict that. But there's no inherent, contradiction between Christianity and being a soldier. But it's what you do as a soldier. Indeed, it's what you do working in an office or working at school as a Christian that matters.
Thank you. What do you find easier from being in combat, in a battlefield, to being a pastor of a church, being a husband and a father now? Are there differences there? Are there places you'd rather be sometimes than you wouldn't rather be?
Yeah, it's interesting, because on the outside you would say, oh, it must be far harder to be in war than it is to be back home. But actually for many years it wasn't, because I was sort of living off the day-to-day adrenaline and the excitement. And I wasn't... When you get home and that stimulation is gone from your life, you suddenly realise, well, what have I got and what do I do for enjoyment? And what's wonderful, God gave me some really good closure, because lots of guys don't get closure. But a year after I'd been home, I was still working for the same company that provided the journalists for Afghanistan. And one of my colleagues in Afghanistan was leaving. So I had to go back there for 3 weeks. And I got sent straight to Helmand to go on a mission with actually the first unit I'd been with in my first ever combat, where the guy got shot in the leg. And I was like, yes, combat time. What was fascinating is I got stuck in Camp Bastion for 3 weeks. I kept trying to fly out to where they were, and every flight I was trying to go on got cancelled. And then Danielle phoned me up on one of the last days I was there and said, Josh, I'm pregnant with our second one. And what was amazing was that God was very clearly closing the door. He said, look, you've had your time. Fair enough, it's over now. And what was fascinating is the first year, in any of the dark moments, the 2 a.m. nappies, I was just like, oh man, it was so cool back then. But after I got back from that little 3 week stint, I never missed it again, because it was clear that that door had closed and that my life had to go on. And yes, do you know what? Like, living at home, there are still so many battles that Christians have to face. Whether it's Christian men, looking at stuff they shouldn't on the internet, or being tempted to get angry or stuff like that, there are so many battles that we face here. And again, the only way that you can really be happy is to trust in God and not to be, oh, I trust in God, but I need a bit of excitement on the side. No, it's full trust in God, loving him with all your heart. And then wherever you are, wherever you're in war, at home, suffering in any way, you're happy because you have Christ. And that's the most important thing.
Just a couple more questions.
Of course.
Yeah. Leading on from that, someone says, you mentioned how we should put our full trust in God.
Yes.
But is that, are you saying then that we shouldn't pursue goals or achievements that we really want and that we should only allow what God gives us?
Oh, no, of course not. No, the important thing here is when you ask yourself with any goal, what is the main reason I'm doing this and how important is it to me if it got taken away? And if this is the thing. If you, let's say you have a goal, you know, you want to be a doctor or something like that. If that was to be taken away from you, how would it affect you? Would it wreck your life and would you be down and out about it? Because if so, then unfortunately, it's higher in your life on your list of priorities than God is. So anything that you put above God, and that isn't just careers, that could be family, it could be love, it could be things that are quite good and the right to love, but anything you love more than God is not good. So that's the thing. God needs to be first. And of course, love your family, have goals, have ambitions. But if they come above God, then they're not good.
Thank you. Last one. Yeah, you mentioned the idea of the toddler emoji going into it. I like that picture. It's a good picture. How do you deal with that now? Do you still have toddler mode tempting you still?
I don't actually. Just to expand a bit more on that thing that I said failed in December, I do animation now as my sort of main line of work. And I've been working on an animated series. You know Warwick Davis? He's the small guy. He's in Harry Potter and so on. So I got to work with him, like writing and directing a series with him in. And, you know, I was like, wow, this is going to be amazing. If this works out, you know, I can be doing this and get more celebrities in and this is great. But it just, you know, it was a good series. The people that saw it liked it. It's on YouTube. It's called Realms of Fighting, if you want to have a look. But it just didn't get the numbers that I needed for it to really, you know, make money or anything like that. And even though it was genuinely heartbreaking, because I was like, I've put so much time into this. I didn't have, you know, a few years before, it would have been instant toddler mode. But I was just like, do you know what, God? You have allowed this to happen. And even though it breaks my heart, I know that I can trust you. And do you know what? Since it failed in December, I have, even, you know, compared to when I was at war, I've never been as close to God as I am now and just trusting him. You know, the job I'm working at the moment, it's okay and, you know, it's freelance work, but tomorrow, if the guy that I mainly work for, if he falls under a bus, I'm in big trouble. And it is just living every moment, you know. And so many times over the past few years, I've been tempted to think, oh, what should I do? You know, what am I going to do next? But do you know what? I'm just trusting God. And I'm the happiest I've ever been right now, even though I've got no projects or little excitements on the side. Just trusting God and knowing him is more fulfilling than anything else.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I do appreciate it.
Give you a big round of applause again. Thank you. Well, that ends the formal time of our time together. Can I just point out to you, if you'd like to read his book, it's here. I got this one off Amazon.
Yeah.
And they're probably about the only place you can find it now. So yeah. Do have a look. Pictures up there. 3 Years at War is called. It's a great read. It's sort of a diary, basically. It's your reports, the diary you've kept. And so you've got the dates and the times of you just recording your thoughts and feelings about your journey and much of what you've shared here, as well as much more detail too. So if you're like a good reader, I recommend picking up that book if you can. And on your tables too, there's a bunch of literature in your little toast racks, and they're all free for you to grab. Some of them are just flyers telling you about the events and things we have here. One of them is the Gospel of Mark. And so that's a free copy for you to take if you'd like them. There are other books there. Can I also just flag up one more thing, which is the Christianity Explore course. And there's an invitation on there, which I would like to invite you, each one of you here this morning, you're very welcome to come and join us at our next Christianity Explore group. We have a meal together for over 6 Mondays, over 6 weeks, and we have a chance to explore the message of Christianity. Can God be trusted, as Josh has asked us and told us this morning? And if you have any questions, any thoughts about that, then this is the place to come, just around someone's home, very informal, and you're all invited to come and join us on our next course. And there's one running right now, but there'll be one coming up in June, and you'll be welcome to join on that. Our website has all sorts of details about the events that we run as well. If you've liked what you heard this morning, or you'd like to listen to it again, it's been recorded, and so it'll be available for you. There's CDs at the sound desk over here, as well as being put online if you'd like to listen. Maybe point it to a friend who you think might be encouraged by what they've heard this morning. Then I encourage you to do that. But thank you again for coming. Don't have to rush off. There's more tea and coffee available. Eat some more cakes. And thank you for joining us this morning.